Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. For more than 30 years, the Library of the American Geographical Society has resided within the Golda Meir Library at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. One key artifact in that library is a scroll representing the history of one family from the Zapotec culture in Mexico. But while the library has had the document for a long time, librarians and historians have only recently figured out the true significance of the item, or even that they had it at all. That fascinating story is covered in the March issue of Milwaukee Magazine in an article by writer Avram Lank. Lank and American Geographical Society Library Curator Marcy Bidney are with us in the studio now. We're also joined via Skype from Spain by Marquette University History Professor Laura Matthew, who studied the document as well. Welcome to all of you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to start with both the American Geographical Society Library and the desk that is at the center of all this, because it sounds like it's at the heart of how this document ended up in Milwaukee in the first place. Marcy Bidney, what is this desk? Where did it come from, and how does the document fit in?
The American Geographical Society Library moved here to Milwaukee in 1978 from New York City. And this desk was the former director's desk. And so as part of the move of the library, just came along with it and was put in the curator's office and just sat there. It wasn't a used desk. It's a very lovely wooden kind of roll top almost type desk. And it has just been sitting in the office for 30 plus years now.
Well, and so how did it manage to reside there for 30 plus years? And this significant document either went undiscovered or certainly underappreciated for all that time.
We knew that it was there. So in about 1995, my predecessor, Chris Baruth, had pulled this document out of the desk and had somebody actually come to take a look at it. And they thought that it was of no real significance and so just rolled it back up and put it back in the desk. Fast forward a couple of years then till last year when Chris was retiring and he was starting to kind of organize all of the things in his office and, you know, just sort of get things situated, opened the desk up again, pulled the scroll out, and one of our staff members urged him to then get a second opinion. And so then that is what started this whole ball rolling in the discovery of what this document actually is.
Was the second opinion, is this where you, Laura Matthew, enter the picture?
In a way, it's even more strung out than that, because I believe first they went to Ames McGinnis, yeah, who's a history professor there at UWM. And he could tell that it was Mexican, and he could tell that it was colonial, but he works on 19th century Panamanian history. But we know each other, of course, because we work in the same city and on the same area of the world. And so he gave me an email, and I came over. And then the really lovely thing was I could tell that it was Mexican and colonial. I could tell the dates that it was produced because it says them on the document. And I could tell the type of document. And I could tell there was an indigenous language there that wasn't the language of Central Mexico, which is the most typical language that you might see on a document like that. And I thought I could tell that the document was about a place that a friend of mine who I had published a book with a few years back named Michelle Udyk, who works at the National University in Mexico City, he had written a book on this town that was mentioned, I thought, in the document. And so I emailed him, and this is the power of email. As it turns out, it wasn't about that town at all, but it was a document actually from a town in this part of Mexico where he primarily works. And he even knew what it was because he and a colleague of his had been looking for it for 10 years based on a photograph of the edge of it that was in the National Anthropology Museum in Mexico City. So he popped me back an email within 30 minutes, and he had identified it, which is just an extraordinary case of good luck, really.
So this was not just a significant document. This was a significant document that no one knew where it was for a good period of time.
Yes. I think that, Marcy, you know the exact date of when it was actually sold from the community in Oaxaca to the fellow who ended up selling it then to someone who sold it to the AGSL, correct?
Right. So it was, we know that a gentleman named Constantino Rickards was probably not the original owner of the map, but he was a British consular official in the Oaxaca area, and he had a large collection of Zapotec and Mixtec artifacts. And he, between about 1911 and 1919, was trying to sell off this collection because he was a miner, and after the Mexican Revolution, had lost all of his money. And so in looking for ways to fund himself, he was trying to sell his collection. So we don't know exactly the date that Rickards sold it to a gentleman named A.E. Place, but it was somewhere before 1917, because we do know that Place sold it to the American Geographical Society in 1917 for $350. And that's then the other, I guess, interesting part of this story is that just about a year and a half ago, the American Geographical Society archives came to the American Geographical Society library. They had also previously lived in New York. And without having the archives here in Milwaukee, it would have been a much more difficult time piecing together this story, because we would have had to go back and forth to New York.
So last fall, I'm at a meeting of the Map Society of Wisconsin, which meets in Marcy's library. And I'm sitting there and I'm hearing this story. And I'm thinking, wow. You know, it works on so many – I mean, I'm a journalist, but it works on so many levels. Just to begin with, it's an interesting document. Never mind that it sort of shows up from the ghosts of time. You also have, in terms of Milwaukee, you have Marquette and UWM working together to try and bring this together. And I think at some point, too, the Art Museum got involved in some of the conservation of it. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, this is very interesting. I wonder how I can tell the story.
Well, and we should we haven't really even described what this document looks like. This is seemingly not your run of the mill, you know, chart. This is a veritable piece of art.
It is, and so it's a 7-foot long rectangular, what's called a lienzo, and it is cloth with painting on it. And in Mesoamerican cartography, the maps, quote unquote, look very different from what Western cartographic maps look like. And so this map is the history of this town. And so it shows time and it shows the different rulers that came along for this particular place that it's showing.
And there's also a linguistic element to it, because there's a lot of Zapotec language in the document, and it's a very unusual form of Zapotec. We say Zapotec, but really there are many Zapotec languages that are as different from each other as, say, French is from Italian. So linguistically, it's a really, really important map as well. And of course, the people in the town are, as from what Michelle tells me, you know, just thrilled, right, to know that this is out there and to have it available. And again, it's the power of the internet. You know, they can actually see pictures of it and be involved in some way in the interpretation of it, which is very special.
Well, and how hard is it, you know, given the differences in the Zapotec dialect or even the Zapotec language, how hard has it been to find someone who's able to actually translate what's in this document?
Well, again, this is the incredible luck that Michelle and I had written a book together, and I went straight to him. He and his colleague, Sebastian von Duisburg, are some of the leading linguists and historical linguists of Zapotec in the world. I wouldn't pick anybody else except Michelle. He's the person that specializes in this in the Linguistic Anthropology Department at the University in Mexico, which is the leading premier university and place of research for this sort of thing. And he works very actively in these communities, so he actually is familiar with a number of different kinds of Zapotec. They don't actually speak the Zapotec anymore in the town. I know that Michelle, you know, is really working. He's having to work to translate this, which means it's also giving him a lot of linguistic information about the development historically of Zapotec and this particular dialect of Zapotec. I think even the map has a label of the hill that's just to the south of the town after which the town is named. But the name Ixtepeji is a Nahuatl name. That's a name from the central Mexican language of the Aztec Empire, which is a translation of the Zapotec. But the people in the town, if I'm not mistaken, what I remember Michelle telling me is that they didn't know the Zapotec name of the town anymore, and it's on the map.
Oh, I didn't know that.
No, neither did I. It was certainly interesting watching him see the map when he came up here right after Thanksgiving, too.
So he was Michelle came just after Thanksgiving. He was in Chicago for a meeting and said, hey, you know, since I'm so close, I'm going to come and take a look at this. And it was really fascinating to watch him look. And so one of the things that I had to ask him twice to make sure I heard him correctly was that at the time he mentioned that this map was only one of two examples of this Zapotec writing. Since then, he just sent me an email, I think last week, saying that he has since found, I think, two more examples of this writing. So it's very unique in that in the linguistic history of this particular region.
What do you hope the ultimate legacy of now having access once again to this document will be? Who is it going to be most useful for? And is it likely to remain in the collection here in Milwaukee in perpetuity, or does it go back to Mexico?
I believe that it will remain in the collection here in Milwaukee. One of my hopes is to be able to create a digital facsimile of this map. We have the ability to then print out a copy of it and then deliver a copy to Santa Catarina because they should have a copy of it. And so that, for me, is very important. Trying to figure out how to create a really good digital facsimile of this is another challenge that I have because it is 7 feet long. And so been working on that. But I think, you know, for this particular area of Mexico, I think linguistically it is very important. Historically, it's very important. I think anybody who studies Mesoamerican history would find this to be a valuable piece. And I think Laura probably can add a little bit more to that as well.
Do you have years of study ahead of you, Laura?
I have years to study ahead of me, but not on this topic. But collectively, and I think, you know, of course, what Avram kept keyed into in the discovery of the document was that we have these connections that are available to us now, and we work collectively, historians and librarians and writers, and whenever we can, and hopefully I think this is increasingly the case, working with the people whose heritage this is, because they also, you know, of course, not only care deeply about it, but know a lot that's not accessible to us as historians looking at colonial documents. When we put all of our heads together, there's such a rich picture that comes out of it. And it's true that now with the digital age, not only do we have the possibility of sharing this information much more quickly than we would have been able to in the past, and also sharing these documents with each other. And as Marcy mentioned, you know, it would be wonderful to get the funding to be able to actually digitalize, not just have a digital reproduction of it, but actually to digitally enhance the Lienzo, because there are parts of it which are very faded and broken, and there's a little corner that's been rolled a bazillion times, and parts are lost. But it's amazing what some kinds of digital restoration can do to bring some things to light that aren't as so apparent when you just look at the document. So it's really exciting. And then you put these things together, we have a much richer appreciation of the history of our hemisphere.
Avram Lenk, how did you happen to be at that meeting of map enthusiasts, if you will?
There is a Map Society of Wisconsin. It's run by some folks in Marcy's library. I happened to play bridge with a fellow who was a member of it, and he said, why don't you come along? And it turns out this was even the first meeting I ever went to of the society.
Oh.
It's a very interesting society, and as I said, the thing that fascinated me just beyond the fact of the map itself was this cooperation amongst all these cultural institutions in Milwaukee. They now have it in this box, this incredible box that was specially built for it. by somebody I believe who works at the art museum,
Jim DeYoung built that box for us to store the map in.
So, you know, my old reporter instincts sort of went into overdrive, and the story was the result, but what it's about is a lot more interesting than the fact of the story itself, obviously.
So you don't roll it up and put it back in the desk at the end of the day anymore.
No, it's so the box that it lives in now, you know, is a little bit longer than 7 feet to be able to capture the whole length of the map, and is very structurally sound. So the bottom of it is kind of like foam board, actually, and so it lays on top of that, and then we have another piece of foam board that sits on top of the map to kind of keep it flat, because it does sort of tend to roll up at the edges still. And then there are pieces of preservation grade paper folded over, and then another piece of plastic that then Velcros onto the top of the box. So it's a very secure, very protected encapsulation for it, and the best way that we could keep it, because we don't have any map cases or drawers or any other way of storing this. So Jim's help in creating this storage box was really fantastic.
Well, and I wonder if, since it had been in this drawer, kind of out of the lights and out of a lot of the air, served to preserve it in some way, that had it kept getting shuffled from place to place and from storage mechanism to storage mechanism, it may not have survived the way it did.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it sat there, you know, it was in its own way protected. And even now, I mean, it's in pretty bad shape for its age. You know, you can still see, you know, most things that are on it. Like Laura mentioned, there are some places that are very faint, and we'd really like to know what they're mostly its words, what those words say. But even still, just from the very few times that we have opened it up for people to see, there are it's still crumbling, and there are pieces now that you can see inside the box. And that, you know, shows just how fragile a piece it is, and that it needs to be kept in this way.
Well, it is a fascinating story on so many levels. Marcy Bidney, Laura Matthew, Avram Lank, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Marcy Bidney is curator of the American Geographical Society Library, based at UW-Milwaukee's Golda Meir Library. Laura Matthew is a professor of history at Marquette University. And Avram Lank is a freelance writer whose story On the Scroll at the AGS Library is in the current issue of Milwaukee Magazine. You can see pictures of the scroll and hear more of the conversation at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Another break now, and in just a moment, a support group seeks to provide mentorship for patients dealing with breast cancer and their families. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.